You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Sasha Woodruff in for Gemma Gaudette. This Saturday, June 19th, marks 156 years since the last Americans were freed from slavery. Today, we're joined by Tanai Jackson, history professor at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and Philip Thompson, executive director of the Idaho Black History Museum. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you much.
Tonight, I'm going to start with you. Can you talk us through the key events that led to enslaved Americans being emancipated?
Yes, absolutely. And I think that it's important to think about the process of the abolition of slavery as being that a process, right? Looking for the moment can be difficult. But I think we should also think of it as part and parcel of the Civil War. There's a lot of talk about whether the Civil War is or is not about slavery. But I think that talking about the Confederacy as definitely being something about slavery makes us think about how there was a sort of little mini civil war happening within the Confederacy itself. So if we think about the outbreak of war in 1861 and secession in 1860, the year before, it breaks down the structures that had held slavery in place so that as soon as the war breaks out and, you know, men go off to fight the Civil War, it leaves that structure broken. Now there's this opportunity. While slaves have been running away from slavery, if you will, since the beginning of slavery, this makes a moment in which that can happen at a critical mass. So in some ways, freedom starts as soon as the Civil War breaks out because enslaved people are escaping in these critical mass numbers. By 1862, there's a Confederate draft, which breaks down that structure even more and leaves even more room for enslaved people to do this sort of freedom with their feet. That leads to the Militia Act in 1862 by the U.S. government, which is a response to the critical mass of enslaved people who have freed themselves showing up at Union military lines. The government's forced to make a decision about how to respond to these people. Officially, the law is the fugitive slave law to send them back. But it's looking like that's a pretty bad military decision to send enslaved people back to the enemy, so to speak. So the Militia Act paves the way for the US government to then incorporate these people into the US military. At that point, this thing becomes a war that is largely about emancipation. This Militia Act is the precursor to what will become the Emancipation Proclamation in 1863, which of course does not exactly free anybody. It doesn't touch at all the four states within the Union that are still slave states. And it is sort of a warning to the Confederacy, come back now or we'll free your slaves, is the warning. And of course, Abraham Lincoln's not the president of the Confederacy as far as they recognize. So that the Emancipation Proclamation, for it to work, has to also be a military measure. Union forces have to defeat Confederate forces in the South, replant that United States flag, and declare that land part of the United States again, thereby emancipating those enslaved people.
Right. And then, and that was in 1863. And then 2 years later, Congress passes the 13th Amendment. The Civil War is coming to an end. But what does that mean for Americans who are still enslaved?
Well, the 13th Amendment is the policy that ends slavery in the United States. That's the policy that makes it illegal. Even the Emancipation Proclamation had not made slavery illegal. It had been done as a military measure, right? But by January 31st, 1865, the 13th Amendment has passed both houses of Congress. Of course, the states still need to ratify it, and that won't happen until December 6th, 1865. So we still have this back and forth happening across the United States about whether or not slavery will be abolished.
Right. And then as the year goes on, the Civil War does end, and then I always thought that, you know, that was it, but it wasn't. There were still states who had slaves. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, exactly. I mean, this is what's so interesting about it and why it's so important to see this as a process. So the 13th Amendment passes both houses, as I say, in January 31st. Of course, we need ratification by the requisite number of states. Now, by April 9th, 1865, Robert E. Lee surrenders at Appomattox. Now, here's where it becomes important to Juneteenth. The Army of the Trans-Mississippi West, which is operating out of Texas, does not surrender with the rest of the Confederacy. And in fact, they hope to hold on and can have an independent Texas Confederate state remaining. Now, that prompts the United States government to send forces into Texas to sort of handle this thing. And sort of unceremoniously, the Army of the Trans-Mississippi West does surrender on May 26, 1865. So this is a little over a month after Robert E. Lee surrendered. It is at that moment that Texas has been brought under this umbrella of the Emancipation Proclamation. They were obviously still in rebellion. Now they qualify for having emancipation take place in that state. And that happens on June 19, 1865. In that way, Juneteenth is the last of these military measures that end slavery. Of course, there are still two states in the Union by this time that it will take until December 6, 1865, and the ratification of the 13th Amendment to finally end slavery everywhere. But as far as the Confederacy goes, Juneteenth is the day.
Right. And, you know, I learned about the Emancipation Proclamation, the 13th Amendment, in school history, but, you know, I never learned about Juneteenth. I was an adult. It wasn't until I moved to California that I actually learned about it. Can you, I mean, for people who don't have a lot of context, can you just explain, like, what the significance of this day is in the Black community in America?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, you know, in some ways, I've wondered a lot about this week in thinking about the nationalization of this holiday. You know, in some ways, in different parts of the United States, different communities celebrate an Emancipation Day on different days. And this is because of this military process and how tightly emancipation was tied to military victory. Right, especially after, you know, the Militia Act, when Black men could serve in the military, then you have these liberating armies coming through, literally emancipating slaves as they move around the South. So every time that happens, those communities have different emancipation days. I think that it's sort of beautiful to celebrate this, you know, Juneteenth as being the last of these military brought emancipation days. And in some ways, I've wondered a lot this week if this is a sort of Western thing, right? Not that it doesn't deserve a national celebration, but there's a very Western element to it in terms of it being the result of this Army of the Trans-Mississippi West surrender. And even more, it's also so dependent on the migration of Texans after the Civil War. So that as a Californian myself, you know, the migration around World War II brought a lot of Texans to California, including my grandfather, who came to work the docks in Oakland, and we settled in San Jose. But the celebration of Juneteenth followed them. And I think in some ways, that's a very common theme for Juneteenth celebrations in the West in particular.
Right. And let's now move over to Philip Thompson. You're the executive director of the Idaho Black History Museum. And you grew up in Idaho. I grew up in neighboring Utah. And, you know, I don't think there was a lot of context for us for this holiday. What does this day mean for Idaho and actually for you specifically?
For Idaho, I think it's so disconnected from the national conversation because, for one, Idaho never practiced slavery. Number two, Idaho didn't become a state till well after the Civil War ended. So like everything from that perspective is much different. And the Black community has always been so small here. But from my personal approach, my grandmother always made us keenly aware, and me in particular, because we just kind of joined at the hip, of our history, our culture, and those events that affected us particularly and specifically. Her being from Arkansas, Juneteenth was another thing that she pushed as far as making sure that we were aware. And it wasn't a big celebratory event, simply because we're in Idaho and it's not a big community and others were not aware of it. But I had always been aware, just because of the teachings of my grandmother, of what Juneteenth was. Granted, it wasn't a grave matter. I wasn't overly aware because I live up north. We don't have like these vestiges of slavery, but the awareness was always there, simply because of the education I received from my grandmother.
And tonight, the focus of your history is Reconstruction. It's the period right after the Civil War. So can you tell me how Juneteenth was celebrated during this time?
Sure. And it's sort of interesting, I think, also that the importance of Juneteenth being that, you know, even in this moment of Juneteenth, like freedom hadn't, there's an interesting question to ask about whether the abolition of slavery and freedom are the same thing, right? And I think that that is the main question during Reconstruction. Like, what does freedom mean? Okay, now that slavery is over, what does that exactly mean, right? Because in 1865, even once the 13th Amendment is passed, there is still not the 14th Amendment. So there's no equal rights under the law for African Americans. And there's still not the right to vote, which it'll take 5 years after the 13th Amendment to do that. And so in some ways, celebrating Juneteenth, particularly in Texas and other areas, was a way to an activist way to push for greater rights. And in some ways, you can see that in their actions. So, for example, in Texas, when African-Americans were banned from public parks, residents in Texas joined together, raised $1,000 to buy a park, which is now Emancipation Park in Houston, just for the purpose of celebrating Juneteenth. And of course, that is also a way to be visible and push for these additional civil rights that are part and parcel of defining freedom during Reconstruction.
And can you just describe a little bit about what those gatherings were like?
Sure. I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing. I was like, so freedom was meant to be seen, I think, at that time, right? Because it's a reinforcement that freedom's real. And so there's one thing even about Juneteenth to me growing up is that it was always a gathering celebration. And I think that, you know, Philip had a great point about when there's large Black populations, that's the case. And this is definitely the case here. I mean, this park is pulling in numbers like 30,000 people, upwards of that, for these celebrations. Food, family, part of family reconnecting after the Civil War is so crucial. And so joining with family, food, celebrations, dressing up, church, these are all things that are music, are all part of Juneteenth.
Okay, and we're going to continue this conversation in just a little bit about the historical significance of Juneteenth and what the holiday means today. Stay tuned, we'll have more right after this break. I'm Sasha Woodruff, and this is Idaho Matters. You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Sasha Woodruff. We're returning to our conversation today about Juneteenth, which is this Saturday. Our guest today, Tanai Jackson, history professor at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, and Philip Thompson, executive director of the Idaho Black History Museum. Welcome back. Tanai, I think you were talking about how this was celebrated and how it was a celebratory gathering of people and food and community. Can you tell me a little bit about how you grew up celebrating this? And I think you said you did grow up in California.
I did. I grew up in San Jose, California. And it's sort of and my family, again, were from Texas. So they had migrated to Texas during this World War II migration period. You know, and I believe that Santa Clara County has celebrated Juneteenth for about the past 40 years. So that sort of shows that, you know, this migration really did bring it forward. And I definitely remember, you know, the dressing up part of it. I remember reading Ebony magazine at my grandmother's house, and there was always, you know, a huge spread about, you know, what people were going to wear and eat and recipes on Juneteenth. But once you got to the Santa Clara County Fairgrounds, you know, in your hat and whatnot, I think that what really stood out was that Juneteenth was, you know, what I've been sort of jokingly calling the Night's Watch of Freedom, if you will. It was a time that once you got there and started celebrating, it was full of all of this knowledge and storytelling and information and organizing in a way that seemed to really try to make sure that we were still focused on making sure that, you know, that the promises of freedom were being actualized. And I think that that's an important part of the process and an interesting thing to sort of move around with the migration of people in celebrating Juneteenth. There really is this sort of joining together because it's such a community event, and making sure that you're rejuvenated to keep on working for the continuation of freedom, which is one of the reasons I think it's a lovely holiday.
Right. And it is on the cusp of becoming a federal holiday. Congress just passed something. President Joe Biden is set to sign something to make it official this afternoon. And so I think this holiday has been a Black American holiday, but as it expands out and becomes something more official, how would you like to see this be a holiday for all Americans?
It's a great question. I think that this is a conversation that comes up around celebrating MLK Day also. And I really want to, again, reinforce that I think this should be a service holiday, right? I mean, when we think about what Juneteenth is about, I think it is about community service and around these notions of freedom. I mean, one of the beautiful reasons to celebrate the last of these, you know, military emancipation days, and that concept of, you know, the final freedom, if you will, is to celebrate this notion that, you know, none of us are free until we're all free.
Right. And Philip, you know, last year, Idaho Governor Brad Little designated June 19th as Juneteenth National Freedom Day in the state. As you watch this state, this holiday evolve in the state and the country, how would you like to see the holiday moving forward?
I agree with what she spoke about previously, that it really needs to be a moment to not only reflect, but actively do something, because we can't fool ourselves into this notion of that after this date, our prayers were answered and everything was good, because one thing that we're really concentrating on is after this was really when like the era of terror began for Black Americans in this weird ambiguous status, that they were no longer in acts of servitude and bound to the land, but nor were they introduced to being, you know, a part of the community and that ability to thrive. So yes, we had Reconstruction helping do so for some time, but then when that was repealed, Blacks really went through hell. So as she said earlier about it being a process, that, you know, first being aware of that, like, okay, in Oklahoma, so my family came from Oklahoma, in what was known as Indian Territory, the emancipation didn't take place there until 1866, that it was still part of this ongoing process. And then Reconstruction was trying that much more to get us reintroduced to the fabric of society. But then when that was removed, you have this history of lynchings, race riots, and truly doing all they can to disenfranchise Black people as being part of this American dream. And that the struggle continues until we are like fully part of the society, which we're still dealing with now. And I think that that's the biggest thing when you take it as a moment to really serve and ensure that you're delivering that promise to all those who have yet to be able to take advantage of what America has to offer. And yes, use it for a moment to gather with your family and celebrate, but that celebration should consist of actively doing something.
Right. And Philip, you have a daughter. What are you going to be doing with her this weekend?
So Junior, she's only 10, but she's well aware of our history from an academic standpoint and the necessity of being aware of our history, but also what we're going to do to move forward to help those who are not able to participate in the same way that our family is, right? So, of course, she'll be at the museum to take, you know, part of the festivities, but more importantly, what is it we're going to do as much as a 10-year-old can do to be aware and work to like help other those join the fold. So one thing we've done is always use like these moments from Black history that even though we're in a city that, you know, Black population is much smaller and not facing the same obstacles, but how can she use her efforts to make sure that people of regardless of their ethnic background are included? So whether it be like making a library, whether it be contributing on a physical level to like build something or do something, whether it be to just open doors of communication with somebody who's different, from a different background, from a different city, making them aware. We have to serve those around us as opposed to just sitting back on our laurels and assuming all is over. There's always an injustice to be fought. You simply have to insert yourself somewhere to do so.
Right. And Tanai, how will you be marking the holiday this year?
Yes, I really do love this idea. I'm sort of piggybacking off of Philip about Juneteenth being this sort of one of the aspects of it being about the spread of knowledge, which I love. And I'm going to be in San Jose, and we will be doing, I think there's some virtual as well as in-person events this year. But there are several workshops that I think are fantastic that are one about sort of spreading knowledge, if you will, about current events. One of the issues is the current Voting Rights Act that is that did not have the same reception in Congress as Juneteenth, but focusing on that. In San Jose, there is a housing crisis, and focusing on home ownership is important there as well. And I hope to be part of that. And so, yeah, I think that, again, focusing on local community organizing that's going on is a fantastic way to celebrate Juneteenth and revive yourself for you know, the struggle that never stops, if you will.
Right. Because, I mean, we are, you know, a year on from, you know, seeing white Americans have a lot of support for the Black Lives Matter movement during the gatherings after the very public killing of George Floyd. But, you know, looking at opinion polls, it shows that white Americans, for their interest in Black Lives Matter issues, it's actually dropped to a lower level than before the pandemic started. So, you know, there still is a lot of work to be done. Do you, and I'll put this to both of you, do you see the making Juneteenth a federal holiday part of this work? And how does that fit into the picture when, you know, in some ways, we are on a contradictory path in this country?
I don't know that we're necessarily on a contradictory path. I think it's a combination of issues of racial animosity, just in general, historically, that's been a problem in America, it always will be. And we don't need to take that as a negative or as something that we can't overcome. It just has to be aware of that variable that's always going to be there. And we're also coming out of like a pandemic fatigue where people are just kind of trying to get back used to whatever this new normal is. And so we can't take that as a reason to despair or get really tribal and say, okay, we're not going to deal with those different from us, whether it be politically or philosophically. Take the time to fix what you can fix in your own area. I mean, Boise, for instance, we're going through record-breaking house prices where people are going to be faced with an existential crisis of how are they going to afford to live in the city of Boise. That's a real tangible, palpable problem that cuts across racial lines that we can all uniformly agree that we really have to do something about this quickly. So using the holiday as a impetus to gather and address issues, that can be a beautiful way to celebrate rather than taking it as a moment to take a step back. Because as I said previously, there's always a fight to be had. You simply need to plug yourself into a place where you're most useful and don't make yourself crazy. But at the same time, don't assume that just because everything's, you know, good for you, that it's good for everybody. And we should be each invested in trying to give everybody else that good life as well.
And tonight, I know San Jose definitely has those housing issues too.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and this is why I really do think that taking a day, I mean, this is a great question about whether a holiday, nationalizing a holiday, can do the work of justice. It's a huge question, right? And more than trying to offer an answer, I think that Juneteenth is a time for us to think about that, right? I mean, I sort of posed a question at the beginning that I think is important to this, you know, is the abolition of slavery and freedom the same thing? I think that the answer is sort of no, right? I mean, the abolition of slavery did not automatically result in equal citizenship for Black people. I think Philip touched on this too, right? There still 14th and 15th Amendment are years from occurring. And once there are gains from Reconstruction, we find that new systems can easily come into place to do the work of oppression, even without slavery, right? I mean, take Jim Crow segregation, I think is a fantastic example. So, I mean, I don't know if we should depend on this holiday to do the work of, you know, sort of racial healing or racial reconciliation or social justice. But I do think that it is a time for us to think about, what does freedom look like here, wherever you are in our communities? Who is maybe not, you know, does not have access to freedom or opportunity in the same way? And I think that things like housing are definitely in the running for this, right? I mean, it's all about what you can do to expand freedom and rights in your own community. And I like this point about we're all sort of coming out of a fatigue. I think that that is true. And I think that Juneteenth is part of that. Okay, here, come, get a plate, get some hugs, get some soothing in, and get ready to do some more work, because there's still work to be done.
Yes, I do like the idea of hugs after this last year. So I want to thank you both so much for joining us today. And again, we were speaking with Tanai Jackson, history professor at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, and Philip Thompson, executive director of the Idaho Black History Museum. Coming up next, some fresh gardening tips. I'm Sasha Woodruff. You're listening to Idaho Matters.